Thank you, Porter. We have a heavy task before us this afternoon. Our job is to try to review the significant decisions of the most recent term of the U.S. Supreme Court. You will understand that we're going to pick a few cases. We'll not try to be comprehensive or exhaustive. But we have some terrific people lined up on the panel. Some will be known to you, but those who are first year will encounter these professors in due course. Let me introduce them now, and then when I turn to them for their presentations, I'll just let them go through in order without further introduction. Lillian Bevere, who's a JD of Stanford University, she is the John Shannon Distinguished Professor of Law here at the university, and she has a connection to the Federalist Society. I think she's on its National Board of Visitors, if I'm not mistaken. John Harrison, who's a JD from Yale, who at one time clerked for Robert Bork, someone whom, as you know, just missed being on the Supreme Court at one time. John Jeffries, the Dean of the Law School, a JD of the University of Virginia. He was Editor-in-Chief of the Law Review here and was a law clerk to Justice Lewis F. Powell, Jr. of the Supreme Court. And finally, Tom Nachbar, a JD of the University of Chicago, who was a law clerk to Frank Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. I think you will agree with me that this is a simply remarkable time to be talking about the Supreme Court. I mean, what's happened in the last few days has taken my breath away. 11 years had passed from 1994 to the present year in which there were no vacancies on the Supreme Court. I don't know what you were doing in 1994. My guess is the Supreme Court was not very much on your mind, unless you were incredibly precocious. So more than a decade went by, and then all of a sudden, things start happening. Justice O'Connor announced her retirement earlier this summer. President Bush proposed John Roberts to take her place. Then, as you know, Saturday night, Chief Justice Rehnquist died. And yesterday, the President moved John Roberts' nomination from the Associate Justice's slot to the one of Chief Justice. Let me just take a quick moment, 30 seconds, to remember William Rehnquist. It seems to me that this panel will inevitably hover under his presence. I had the pleasure, as did others here, of knowing him. He was, in personal terms, unassuming, unostentatious, a person who was genuinely liked by everybody at the court, no matter what their view of his political philosophy. He was universally respected. In judicial terms, he was somebody who, for years after his appointment to the court, was a very lonely figure. From 1972, when he took his seat, to 1986, when he became Chief Justice, he was often a lone dissenter. It seemed like he really was not making much headway with his particular agenda for the court. In 1986, when he became Chief Justice of the United States, there really was not, in a genuine sense, yet any conservative bloc on the court. Justice Scalia took his seat that year. He had just been appointed. Clarence Thomas was not yet on the court. His time was to come. Perhaps as equally as important, Justices Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan were still on the court. These were the stalwart holdovers from the more liberal Warren Court, so there was an authentically liberal presence on the Supreme Court as of 1986. Indeed, during the so-called Burger Court years from 1969 to 1986, the counter-revolution that Richard Nixon and others hoped would come about on the Supreme Court simply did not. The Burger Court was really more like the Warren Court than it was like its successor. And of the four Nixon appointees to the court, probably the only consistent conservative of the lot on the court was William Rehnquist. To give one or two examples of where the court was in 86, to give you a sense of how far we've come to what we'll be talking about today, federalism. The 10th and 11th Amendments were largely moribund. The Commerce Clause seemed limitless. There was no reason to think the Supreme Court would place any limits on the power of Congress to legislate in the name of Article I. In the area of church and state, the wall of separation was very sturdy, having been built by the Warren Court and built even further by the Burger Court, and efforts of people like William Rehnquist to try to begin to dismantle that wall had not been very successful. Final example, substantive due process, from a very modest beginning in the Griswold case in 1965, the Due Process Clause exploded into lots of applications in the privacy and autonomy areas, the most obvious example being Roe versus Wade in 1973. So William Rehnquist, if he wanted to change things, was up against a pretty substantial obstacle. If you look at the years that have now passed, from 1986 to the present time, we have seen the emergence in the court of something like a genuine conservative bloc, not in every case a consistent controlling bloc, not an always controlling majority, but certainly a dependable conservative bloc of Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist. Brennan and Marshall have left the court, so the commander-in-chief and his principal ally on the left wing of the court are no longer there, and much attention has been called to the role of the centrist on the court, O'Connor in particular. As I say, there have been no retirements. The court was fairly stable in membership during the last decade until this year. One can see in the Rehnquist court, during his time as Chief Justice, certain themes emerging. I'll only mention one or two. One is a rediscovery of federalism, a renaissance of the 10th and 11th Amendments in a way that it would be difficult to imagine a generation ago. Secondly, the wall of separation of church and state. Rehnquist has begun to move that part of the court's jurisprudence towards a more deferential view of state power to accommodate religion. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about the modern Rehnquist court, at least with some exceptions, has been it's exuding an air of self-confidence. It used to be one thought that judicial activism was always on the left. I think one can make a strong case that there's a good deal of judicial activism on the right in the Rehnquist court. And if you need any other examples, I think the best one might well be Bush versus Gore in the year 2000, when the court, as you know, stepped in, ended the contested election process in Florida, and in effect decided who the next president would be. But even as I generalize, if I were to try to sum up the Rehnquist court, the last two or three terms give one pause. Something very peculiar is going on in Washington. It's almost as if nothing is ever stable, as if the court is always searching for its true self. And the last term or two have made it much more difficult to generalize about the Rehnquist court. Cases like Lawrence versus Texas, the case striking down the Texas anti-sodomy statute, the Michigan affirmative action case upholding the use of race as a marker in law school admissions, and in the last two or three years, two capital punishment cases, one involving youthful offenders and the other the moderately mentally retarded, cases overruling fairly recent precedents of 1989. So something very remarkable is going on, and it comes to a head, I think, in the term that my colleagues will talk about in a moment. It was a quite interesting term, not boring at all. There were cases on the docket this term involving such things as wine, marijuana, sex. I mean, you know, what's not to like about a term like that? I mean, if you're a court watcher as I am, that really does prick your senses indeed. Some of the highlights of the court's term, this is to simply frame what my panelists will say in a moment. Two closely watched cases involving the Ten Commandments. Secondly, a rebuff to the so-called property rights movement, a broad reading of the public use language of the Constitution. Thirdly, a rather generous reading of several federal civil rights statutes, more generous than the court has been accustomed to in recent years. Fourthly, deference to Congress in areas of the Commerce Clause and Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Fifth, I mentioned the two death penalty cases. One of those was this term, further cutting back on the power of the states to implement their capital punishment laws. And finally, a debate over how to read the Constitution. In particular, as you, I'm sure, know, a quite fascinating debate over the extent to which it's appropriate for the justices of the Supreme Court to cite or refer to international norms like the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, finally, before I turn to our panel, just a word about statistics. Raw numbers don't always tell you very much, but it is interesting that the court under William Rehnquist simply decides fewer cases than it used to. It used to be you'd have about 150 cases a year. In the past term, 80 cases decided on the merits, about half of what they used to decide. Of those 80 cases, about a third of them, 24 cases, were 5-4 decisions. So there are a lot of closely divided questions before the court, and they're often the toughest and most controversial ones. And that figure, of course, highlights the importance of the vacancies that are now being filled on the court. Indeed, I was struck by the fact that if you take the five most conservative justices on the court, the conservative bloc that I just mentioned, plus O'Connor and Kennedy, they held together as a voting five justices only five times out of 24 cases. And that's a much lower bit of grouping than would have been true in previous terms. Well, that's by way of backdrop onto the cases of this term itself. As I said a moment ago, we're not trying to be exhaustive. Our panelists have been asked to pick just a few cases, which we hope will highlight some of the interesting things about the term. So, in the following order, I'll ask each panelist to talk about the following cases without any further introduction on my part. And then when they're done, we have a few minutes for questions and the like. No cold calling in here, you may be sure. This is not graded work, so you can embarrass yourself before your friends, but I think you'll get over that. Now, here's what we plan to do. Tom Nachbar will look at MGM versus Grosker. That's the case involving file sharing and copyright infringement. We put that first because of your immediate and practical interest in that issue, no doubt. Secondly, John Harrison will look at a pair of cases, the Gonzalez versus Raich case involving California's medical marijuana law, and secondly, Granholm versus Held, which is the case involving state regulation of interstate shipment of wine. Thirdly, Lillian Bevere will look at the case which surfaced to become, I think, at least in the public mind, the most controversial case of the term, and that is Kelo versus New London, a case involving the taking of private property for so-called public use. And then finally, Dean Jeffries will look at a pair of cases, Van Orden versus Perry and McCreary County versus ACLU. They are the two cases involving the public display of the 10th Amendment. I think you've got a wonderful treat in store for you now, and I want to turn first to Tom Nachbar.
Thanks, Steve. Well, as Professor Howard suggested, I'm here to talk today about the Grosker case. It's a little hard to introduce this case because the conduct that led to the case itself was basically an attempt by makers of file sharing software to evade an earlier rule of copyright law. So it's not clear whether you should start with the conduct or the rule that the conduct was intended to evade. I like to think of all great lawsuits as starting with a single miscalculation. This one, I think, started with a series of miscalculations, and so I'm going to go through them chronologically. The first one took place in 1984 when the Supreme Court decided Sony versus Universal Studios, which was a case about whether or not makers of video cassette recorders would face contributory copyright infringement for selling video recorders, right? The idea is that people use video recorders to infringe copyrights by making copies of television shows and movies. And the question is whether or not makers of those devices can be held liable for facilitating that copying. And there's a general rule in copyright law and tort law generally about contributory liability for aiding and abetting or assisting these kinds of acts. The problem is that the case was fairly limited. It was limited to liability for selling the VCRs. And the VCRs, it turns out, were used primarily for time shifting, which, you know, you all might be slightly familiar with doing, right? I mean, do you watch any shows on live television? I don't watch any shows on live television at all. The idea of taping a television show to watch it at a different time. The court held that was a fair use. That was actually a use that's permitted under the copyright statute, even though it's technically the making of a copy. And the VCRs were also used for librarying, which may or may not be a fair use. But the court formulated a much broader rule than what it would have needed to resolve the case. They seemingly exempted from indirect infringement those who distribute devices that are capable of substantial non-infringing uses. And, of course, the VCRs and Sony were not just capable of it. They were actually used primarily for what was held to be a non-infringing use. So you get this fairly broad statement in Sony, which raised the possibility that a theoretical non-infringing use, right, might actually balance out and justify a present infringing one. All right, so here's this invitation that's made in Sony. In 2001, the Ninth Circuit decided one of the most important file-sharing cases out there, the Napster case, which held both that peer-to-peer file-sharing is not a fair use, right, and that so You know, when you share your files, this may come as a surprise to some of you, when you share your files with others over the Internet, or when you copy files from people over the Internet using file sharing software, chances are pretty good that you're infringing the copyrights and you're liable under the Copyright Act. I'm sure that you'll all go home and lose a tremendous amount of sleep over that this evening. So the court held that peer-to-peer file sharing was not a fair use, and that was actually a fairly heavily argued question in that case. And they also held that a company that not only distributes peer-to-peer software, but also maintains a central index of where the files are located, right? You know, you use the index in order to find where files might be located on another peer computer, that hosting the index actually would lead to contributory infringement. So in that case, Napster, they not only distributed the software, they maintained this ongoing index for their users to use to find infringing works. Okay. And they could not avail themselves of the Sony capable of substantial non-infringing uses test because it's a test for constructive knowledge of infringement, and in Napster, because they were maintaining a present index, they had actual knowledge of infringement. They were actually assisting with individual infringements. Okay. The third miscalculation was that of the defendants who read Napster and designed their own peer-to-peer software without a central index in the hope that their software would be used in exactly the same way as the Napster software, but without leaving them open to contributory copyright liability, right? They read the Ninth Circuit case. They said, oh, well, it's the central index that matters. We'll design software without a central index. People will use it exactly the same way, but we'll be off the hook because we don't have the index, and what they really care about is the index. And that's what's critical to the Sony test. It's hard to tell if their primary miscalculation was designing software with the intent to encourage infringement or taking legal advice from the Ninth Circuit, but in either case, they wound up in big trouble, and they wound up getting sued. And the next miscalculation winds up being one that is made by virtually every intellectual property scholar and lawyer in the country, and assuming that this case had anything to do with Sony, right? When the case went up to the Supreme Court, virtually everyone who looked at it considered that the case was raising a question of either whether this conduct fell under the Sony safe harbor or whether the court might actually re-examine Sony, right? Because everyone thought, you know, this is clearly a Sony matter, and either they're going to have to re-examine Sony or they're going to have to ask how this fits into the Sony test. The Supremes, however, figured out the case was about a bunch of guys who intended to make money by encouraging others to infringe, but they were trying to be clever about it, right? And they weren't hearing this Sony argument really at all, and they ostensibly decided in a unanimous decision that the case wasn't about Sony, but was about what to do when someone purposefully sets out to create a product that they intend will be used primarily for copyright infringement. Now, they had a lot of evidence about the purpose, and so they were able to switch from a test about whether or not to infer knowledge based on what was going on to a test where they could point to specific aspects of the purpose that they displayed in engaging this behavior. So the defendants went after users of Napster, for instance. They advertised to them specifically, created Napster-like software that they distributed that would work with the Napster system in the hope that when Napster got shut down, the users of that software would shift to the defendant's software. They helped users search for copyrighted recordings. They used copyrighted recordings in their advertising screenshots. One of them had a top 40 search where you could limit your search to top 40 songs, which all of which were likely to be copyrighted, obviously. They also sold advertising space based on volume, which made them financially interested in having their software used for high-volume transactions, which are more likely to happen in conjunction with popular copyrighted works. They refused to cut off infringers. Sometimes they would take down the files they posted. In fact, they actually blocked the attempts of the recording industry to monitor the traffic on the software or on these networks to figure out whether or not copyright violations are taking place. They actually interfered with attempts to prevent copyright infringement. And so the court basically decided that the Sony test had overwhelmed its purpose of asking about culpability and assigning culpability through knowledge, right? The Sony test was about figuring out whether or not someone was culpable based on the knowledge that they had about use of the product for infringement, and they focused instead directly on culpability, which makes an awful lot of sense, right? In so doing, they, you know, in this brilliant unanimous opinion, brilliant might be too strong a term, they injected a healthy dose of common sense into the copyright law, which had been fixated on this abstraction in Sony. Six of them then proceeded immediately to overwhelm this injection of common sense with an invitation to more speculation on the Sony rule. So there's a unanimous opinion in Grokster, and then there are two concurrences, one written by Justice Ginsburg and one written by Justice Beyer, which speculate on what would have happened if the case had been governed by Sony, even though this one was not. It's unique, right? You've got a unanimous case that has this good, common sense, solid approach to solving a problem, right, in which six justices still apparently have completely missed the boat. And I don't know whether they were unhappy with an outcome that sidestepped the controversy over Sony, or they were simply brainwashed by the tidal wave of amici briefs by amici. But in any case, they went down this path. I don't think either one of the concurrences warrant much discussion. Their existence at the end of the case, I think, demonstrates just how hard it is to convince these people to stop talking. Here we have a case that was started, I think, largely as a result of a court 20 years ago not stopping talking in time, right? They didn't stop soon enough, and they came up with this overly broad rule which carries on and takes on a life of its own over time. They come up, they realize, of course, that this rule has taken on a life of its own. They come up with a much better solution and then continue the separate life of the rule. This, you know, every story is a moral. The Supreme should shut up has always been one of my favorite morals. But I don't think actually that is the primary moral of this story. I think that the primary moral of this story is that the Federal Circuit is a bad idea. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has exclusive jurisdiction over appeals from cases that involve patents. Right? If you bring a patent case, you bring a patent infringement case in a district court, if it's appealed, it winds up being appealed not to the geographically located Court of Appeals, but to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, the Central Court of Appeals. Its primacy in patent law is really virtually unmatched by any other area of law, at least in American law. And I think that Grokster shows what happens when you take something, an area of law, and you isolate it from other areas of law. In this case, it happened through an abstraction, right? The Supremes created an abstraction, and people got caught up in the abstraction. And eventually, people forgot about the fact that the rule was really tied to common law sensibilities about culpability and contributory liability and tort, and became overwhelmed with the specific rule and the way that it applied in this one area of law. And having a generalist Supreme Court instead of having specialized high courts, I think, does an awful lot to bring more common sense to these what become highly specialized questions of law. And I think that it's good that we have a generalist Supreme Court. I think it's good that we're generalists. And I think that it behooves us to continue in that tradition as opposed to leaning towards more specialist courts, especially as in civil tradition, specialist constitutional courts. I mean, all the other panelists are going to talk about constitutional questions. We have this perception that the Supreme Court is dominated by constitutional questions. That's actually not true. The majority of the cases that they hear are regular federal statutory claims or largely federal statutory claims, and I think that keeping their grounding in these more general claims in a variety of areas of law helps them keep perspective not only in those areas but in the constitutional areas as well.
Thank you, Tom. John Harrison.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking about Granholm against Held and Gonzalez against Raich, one of which, as Dick indicated, is about marijuana. The other is about wine. So I'm going to be talking about drugs. Tom just talked about rock and roll. So you see what's left. Granholm against Held, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, is about state laws that restrict the access to state wine markets of out-of-state vineyards that give preferential treatment to in-state producers of wines. Normally, such discriminatory regulation of trade by a state would violate the so-called Dormant Commerce Clause, a doctrine that the Supreme Court came up with sometime in the 19th century. But there are special rules, both constitutional and statutory, specifically for liquor. There is a statute, the Webb-Kenyon Act. There is a provision of the Constitution, which is the only provision of the Constitution that you personally can violate. This is a great opportunity for you. Section 2 of the 21st Amendment says that the importation into a state of alcohol in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. The question is, to what extent do the Webb-Kenyon Act, which is a statute from about 1912 that does similar things, and Section 2 of the 21st Amendment give the states power to restrict alcohol imports from other states and thereby perhaps discriminate against other states' commerce that they otherwise wouldn't have? It's about the interaction between the dormant commerce clause and those two provisions. I will say for me, this case posed a grave moral dilemma. Because on one hand were free trade and cheap wine, really good things. On the other hand was a rigid, wooden, mechanical, and formalistic interpretation of the Constitution, which is, of course, the summum bonum as far as I'm concerned. So I found myself caught in a terrible, as I say, moral dilemma about the case. The court, 5-4, but with a slightly odd 5-4 configuration, held against the states. The states lost both of these cases. The other case is Raich against Gonzalez, where the Gonzalez is Attorney General Gonzalez. And the question there is whether the Federal Controlled Substances Act, which forbids the production of marijuana, applies to the production of marijuana for compassionate use, that is to say, medical use, by someone who grows it personally, does not sell it, does not buy it, and uses it locally. That is to say, can the Federal Commerce Power, which is the ground of the Controlled Substances Act, reach an action growing and consuming marijuana that is, as Justice Jackson said in the great case about this, Wickard against Filburn about 60 years ago, that is neither interstate nor commerce? The Supreme Court's answer, does the interstate commerce power reach something that is neither interstate nor commerce, was, of course, yes, by another 5-4 vote. So as I say, the states lost both of the cases. I think they are extremely interesting because they both present a fundamental question. Is it possible, and if so, how, for states that are part of a federal union to pursue quite divergent social policies? And to understand why that's a question and how it comes up, first in the context of Granholm against Held and then in the context of Raich, it's necessary to know why there was such a thing as Section 2 of the 21st Amendment, why there was a Webb-Kenyon Act. And the answer goes back to around the turn of the 19th or the 20th century, when one of the great moral crusades underway in America was prohibition. And as a consequence, there were some states that were wet and some states that were dry. But those states were together in a federal union, and to some extent they had given up the powers that a fully sovereign state would have. And according to then-existing Supreme Court doctrine, which was importantly different from currently existing Supreme Court doctrine under the Dormant Commerce Clause rubric, according to then-existing Supreme Court doctrine, the states, by entering the federal union, had lost the power to control their borders. They could not regulate interstate commerce. Only Congress could regulate interstate commerce. And that meant that dry states had very limited power to control the importation of alcohol. This produced the excellent practice of the American Express Company becoming a great importer of booze. And since the court implemented this concept with the so-called original package doctrine, which said a state could not regulate something that came in interstate commerce as long as the something was still in the original package, there developed the fine institution of the original package saloon, in which alcohol would be imported into a state still in the original package, sold to the ultimate consumer still in the original package, and consumed in a supposedly dry state. This was a loophole for prohibition created by the federal union, and hence a serious threat to what the dry states thought was a fundamental policy choice they had made about their social systems, to eliminate alcohol and all the evils that went with it. The result, first, was the Webb-Kenyon Act, in which Congress said, well, if the states can't regulate interstate traffic in liquor, we can. And we say that the importation into a state of alcohol, contrary to the laws of that state, that is to say, into a dry state, is forbidden. That was an achievement by the drys in around 1912. A few years later, of course, they got what they really wanted, which was a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment, eliminating the divergence among states between wet and dry states and making the entire country dry and, as it turned out, bone dry. Of course, not too long after that, the 18th Amendment was repealed by the 21st Amendment. The great thing about the 21st Amendment is it is the only amendment that, when submitted by Congress, was sent to state conventions rather than state legislatures for interesting political reasons. Conventions are thought more directly to represent the people than are state legislatures. And this was the first time conventions had been used since the ratification of the Constitution itself, which is to say that since the ratification in 1788 and 1789, the only thing that the authentic voice of the American people have said is the 21st Amendment, and what they said was, we want a drink. But when they said that, they said it in a fashion that continued to respect federalism and the capacity of the states to decide themselves to be dry, to pursue divergent social policies. And hence there is Section 2 of the 21st Amendment, which puts a rule like the Webb-Kenyon Act into the Constitution. The court decided in Granholm against Helm that despite all that, Section 2 of the 21st Amendment does not override the Dormant Commerce Clause. Whether that's correct or not, you can decide for yourselves by reading the opinions. I will warn you that the majority opinion is by Justice Kennedy. The important thing to see about the Webb-Kenyon Act and Section 2 of the 21st Amendment is that they are exercises of national power, national regulation of interstate commerce, in the service of state choices, in the service of state autonomy. And oddly enough, much can be said about much of the economic regulation that we're familiar with from the New Deal, and in particular the economic regulation that gave rise to the great case of Wickard against Filburn, which held that Congress, pursuant to the commerce power and the necessary and proper power, could regulate a wheat producer, Roscoe Filburn, who produced wheat for his own personal consumption. Nevertheless, said the court in Wickard, that can be reached. And the reasoning was as follows. First, suppose that there were a depression, and states believed that the way to get out of the depression was to increase the purchasing power of producers by raising prices, in effect by fixing prices. The problem for any one state that wanted to pursue such a policy of raising prices, especially when they were in a federal union that had free trade against the states, was that if they tried to raise the price in the state, people would simply buy from out of state. Their system of price controls to pursue the economic and distributive policy of raising incomes and thereby getting out of the depression would collapse. In order, the states, that is to say, were in a collective action problem. If any one of them tried to pursue this goal itself of raising prices, the federal union would undercut them. The solution to a collective action problem is, of course, central authority. So for a lot of New Deal economic policies, including, for example, the regulation of agricultural prices, which underlay Wickard against Filburn, the primary normative justification for federal action was this idea that the states can't act separately because they have a collective action problem. If any one of them acts, it will be undercut by competition from other states, even though all the states would be better off if they all acted to raise prices. Whether, in fact, you can get out of a depression by restricting output is a logical question, but we'll put that aside. That is to say, the normative justification for federal power, given in the New Deal, and in particular in the regulation of interstate agricultural markets, which generated the regulation of Filburn's production of wheat, was, again, respect for state autonomy. That the states wanted to make a choice, but they couldn't. Their autonomy was curbed by the collective action problem that they had by being in competition with one another. The solution was for Congress to set the price in interstate markets and to say, sorry, Filburn, you can't raise wheat even for your own personal consumption because that withdraws you from the market and that undercuts the increased price that Congress is trying to create on the interstate market for wheat. So oddly enough, the argument that begins with state autonomy, states desiring to raise prices, then goes through federal power and creates a federal power to reach into the states to regulate something that is neither commerce nor interstate. Now that, the states being in a collective action problem, as I say, the fundamental normative justification for a lot of New Deal regulation, including the one at stake in Wickard against Filburn. But you may be thinking, but that means that despite the fact that the court thought that Gonzalez against Raich, the marijuana case, was Wickard against Filburn all over again, it's not Wickard against Filburn all over again. Because Raich is actually much more like the Webb-Kenyon Act. Raich is about states wanting to pursue divergent social policies concerning how lenient or how tough to be with respect to their drug laws. And what Congress has done in the situation in the Controlled Substances Act at issue in Raich is not to try to buttress state autonomy, either in the fashion done with the Webb-Kenyon Act or Section 2 of the 21st Amendment, or in the more indirect fashion, getting the states out of the collective action problem, done in New Deal economic regulation. Congress has simply imposed its own uniform social policy of having very serious restrictions on marijuana. And when California and some other states say, no, we want to pursue a different social policy, we want to have more divergence among the states in this federal structure, the answer under the Controlled Substances Act is simply, no, you can't do that, because this question is going to be decided at the national level, not in any sense in order to reinforce state autonomy, but simply to decide it at the national level. As I say, I think, therefore, the cases are alike in a fashion that the court did not see. I have three observations growing out of that. The first is that questions about social policy, to be wet or dry, what policy should be with respect to drugs, present, I think, generally much more serious and much more difficult questions of federalism, how much state autonomy should there be, wet states and dry states, than do questions of economic policy. The current question of social policy about which the possibility of state divergence is most powerful is, of course, whether to have same-sex marriage, whether it is possible and desirable to have a non-uniform national rule on same-sex marriage. That is observation number one. That those questions, the social policy questions, are the really hard questions for federalism. The second observation, those questions are not going away. We've seen them before, wet or dry. We see them in Raich, and as I said a moment ago, we see them now most pointedly with respect to same-sex marriage. Third observation, if you read especially the majority opinion in Raich, the Supreme Court seems completely unaware of this. The Supreme Court does not see the questions raised, despite having decided, held in the same year, does not see the questions raised in Raich as being different from the economic policy questions raised in Wickard against Filburn, does not see this as being about divergent social policies and whether there should be federalism with respect to social policy. That's true both of the majority in Raich and of Justice Scalia's concurrence in the result in Raich, in which he takes a quite formalistic, characteristically enough, approach to the problem, but nevertheless seems to reach the conclusion that I can't imagine he really believed that would have been constitutional in 1910 for Congress to impose nationwide uniform prohibition. The last observation I want to make is that these questions, whether to have divergent or uniform national answers on questions of social policy, like, for example, same-sex marriage, are really, really, as I say, really, really hard questions for the court and for the federal system, that they are the questions that are likely to be before, as it turns out that there is one, the Roberts Court. I am one of the people who thinks that most of the so-called federalism revolution in the Rehnquist Court, the cases restricting congressional power under the Commerce Clause, the cases extending state sovereign immunity, are a tempest in a teapot, practically speaking, that their actual practical effect is not very large. But questions about divergent social policy, like, for example, same-sex marriage, whether to have one or many answers across the country, that's not a tempest in a teapot. That's a hurricane.
John, thank you. Lillian Bevere.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking about the Kelo case, and I'm sorry I can't. I've been sitting here trying to listen to John, but also trying to think about something sexy about it or something that. So I'm going to leave that to the dean. He's doing the Ten Commandments. You probably are familiar with the Kelo case. It's the case where, in pursuance of an economic development project in New London, Connecticut, the private homes of several protesting landowners were permitted to be taken. The homeowners challenged the taking on constitutional grounds. The Constitution provides that private property shall not be taken for a public use without just compensation being paid. The homeowners made what would seem to be a textually appealing argument that taking property from them and handing it over to private developers was not taking for public use. The court said, well, sorry about that. Public use is the same thing as public purpose, and economic development is a public purpose. End of story. Justice Stevens wrote the majority opinion in Kelo, and an interesting article appeared in the New York Times on August 24th describing a talk that Justice Stevens gave at a Bar Association meeting in Las Vegas, where he claimed that he thought the outcome was unwise, but he had no choice. He was convinced that the law compelled a result that he would have opposed had he been a legislator. He is a legislature, so he doesn't need to become a legislator. He's never mind. One can have a cynical view of that statement because, of course, the political firestorm had intervened between the time the case was decided and the time Justice Stevens discovered that really he hated the outcome of the case, but he was compelled to decide it. And certainly if you read the opinion, there's not a hint in it of doubt or worry about whether this project in New London is a good one, whether the purpose, the public purpose, is a worthy one, whether there's any possibility of working the court's way out of this supposed doctrinal stranglehold that he said they were in. And in fact, I think one has to really doubt whether the stranglehold existed. The two cases upon which the court relied, I'm going to talk about for just a moment. One was Berman versus Parker, and that was a case that was decided in 1954. It was a slum clearance project in which the protesting landowner said, my property is in a slum. And the court said, it's true, it's not, but it's in a slum neighborhood, and we're going to take this whole slum and get rid of the slum, and that's a good thing. And the court said, that's all right, this is for a public use, and they described slum clearance as a public use in very, very utopian sort of language. Justice Douglas, who was sort of known for flights of fancy occasionally, said, we do not sit to determine whether a particular housing project is or is not desirable. The concept of the public welfare is broad and inclusive. The values it represents are spiritual as well as physical, aesthetic as well as monetary. It is within the power of the legislature to determine that the community should be beautiful as well as healthy, spacious as well as clean, well-balanced as well as carefully patrolled. And he also seemed to think that that was, not only was it within the power of Congress to want that, it was in the power of Congress to achieve that result. Berman versus Parker, it's noteworthy, was decided at a time when there was a considerable amount of faith in central planning and in the ability of governments, both national and local, to accomplish projects like substantial and benign redevelopment of cities. And that faith, I think, is epitomized in the comments of Justice Douglas in this opinion. But they are very broad, right, in their very acceptance of the idea that legislatures should be able to decide that they want to do this and then be given the power to do it. The next case to which the court referred was a case called Hawaii Housing Authority versus Midkiff. And in that case, the court sustained a program in which the state of Hawaii required the owners of residential property in Hawaii to sell their property on they did not desire to sell their property to their tenants. And the argument, of course, they argued that you can't take my property and give it to another private person. That's not a taking for public use. The court sustained that taking as a taking for public use, unfortunately citing some of the language in Berman, but also talking a lot and at length about the oligopoly in land ownership in Hawaii, and that was what the Hawaii legislature was attempting to fix. Moreover, in Midkiff, it can be said that it's true, there was a redistribution. It was taking A's property, giving it to B. It's also true, this may not matter, but it seems true and worth noting, that the redistribution in Midkiff was from very rich to much less rich, from rich to poor. And if you're going to redistribute, it's via the takings clause. It seems as though that might be the way you'd want to go, rather than taking from relatively less well-off or relatively poor people and giving it to rich developers so that they can get even richer and thus pay more taxes to the local community. In any event, I think what happened in Kelo was the court felt that these two precedents constrained its ability. They felt that the dicta in both of them, that broad dicta I just cited from Berman, compelled the result that they were going to reach. I think that this extreme deference was not necessarily required or compelled by these precedents that the court cited. I think that it would have been quite possible for the court to say, we're going to look at this a little bit more carefully. We're going to take a serious look at the court's, at the city's statement that this is for a public purpose. We are likely with this redevelopment project to achieve the public purpose. It is true that the City of New London is in dire financial straits. We are actually quite certain that this is going to help it to recover from that and provide jobs and taxes and so forth. And then to ask another question or to seriously inquire about whether the property that was being taken was actually going to be necessary to achieve this public purpose. The court did not look at any of that, did not address those questions in a serious way. Basically, what the court said was, it's not our call. We take the legislature's word for it, the legislature of New London's word for it, that this project is for a public purpose, that they're trying to do good things for the community. We take the legislature's judgment for the fact that these properties are going to be contributing to that project, and therefore, who are we to decide? And it's an interesting kind of deference. It's interesting, the extreme deference. It's almost beyond what we know as rational basis review, which is not really a very close look at all. It's basically a sort of declaration that we are completely incapable of knowing what's going on here, so we're going to trust the City Council to make the decision for us. Very uncharacteristic, I must say, of Justice Stevens in many respects, but we'll leave that part aside. I'd like to talk a little bit about the faith in eminent domain that was reflected in Berman versus Parker and how that faith has perhaps not been borne out by events and by the way these projects have turned out. I think it's at least fair to say that a good deal of skepticism about whether these projects work as planned is probably warranted. Perhaps you are familiar with the poster child of the property rights movement, I think, is the Pole Town case in Michigan, where a neighborhood of lower middle class and working class ethnic residents was just taken by eminent domain to put up a GM plant that was promising to hire 6,000 workers and to make Detroit into a revitalized city. Well, the plant never quite made good on that promise, but the residents were nevertheless removed from their homes. Those kinds of events where people are dispossessed against their will, often from their homes, and where the projects then do not deliver anything like the promised benefits, I think in combination led to an awareness that that was the kind of thing that might happen in New London, led to the political firestorm that followed after the Kelo decision. The question, however, is more difficult than the sort of emotional content of it might suggest, and the question is whether public use is, in fact, a judicially manageable limitation on legislative power. Of course, the text can be read to imply that it is, because the text, private property shall be taken for public use without just compensation being paid, suggests that this is not just a grant of power to take property for public use, but a limitation on that power. If you can take it for public use, but you can't take it for private use. It suggests, the text does, that there's a distinction of constitutional dimension between public use and private use. It suggests, I think, that Congress meant public use if it had meant, wanted to say public purpose, or that the Constitution, the framers meant, if meant you take for public use, you don't take for public purpose. We know the difference between a use and a purpose, or one would, might think that they would have. I don't want to talk about the text so much. Justice O'Connor thought that the public use standard would was judicially enforceable. She thought that there was an enforceable principle in the distinction between taking to prevent harm, which was Berman, which was Midkiff, and taking to confer a benefit, of which was the taking in Kelo. It conferred the benefit of economic development. There are many reasons to think that's not a workable principle. I won't go into them. Justice Thomas thought that the government should actually take property only if it was going to actually use the property or give the property, give the public a right to use the property. Many reasons to think that very, very, very bright line rule is not workable. I'm not going to go into those. What I do want to talk about for just a moment is this political fallout and what it means. I read somewhere the following statement. A Supreme Court ruling that allows the government to seize private property has set off a fierce backlash that may yet be as potent as the anti-abortion movement. I want to suggest to you that this is a very, very different case from Roe versus Wade. This is a case in which you can say, unlike the cases that Professor Harrison was talking about, that there's a real federalism content in this. What the court said in Roe was states may not regulate abortion, period. It took the power away from states to achieve their social policy goals. What the court said in Kelo is states may, or in effect what the court said in Kelo, states may, if they wish, regulate the takings power more strictly than the Constitution does. Kelo says that states may take property for public purpose. It doesn't say states must take property for public use. Right? It's a big difference. What this does is almost explicitly throw the ball into the political arena, and that's may very well be, given the difficulty of articulating enforceable principled standards, where it belongs. A week after Kelo, the House of Representatives passed a motion disagreeing with it by a margin of 10-1. Constitutional amendment to overrule it is before the House of Representatives. There's a similar bill before the Senate. One doubts that they'll go anywhere, but they have been introduced. In a recent poll, 90% of Americans said that they disapprove of the kind of seizures allowed in Kelo. Well, who wants to think that your government can come in and take your house? A number of states have introduced legislation. Several have actually passed legislation. So the political process in the states has got a lot of momentum going. Now, what that causes me to think, and this is going to be my last comment, that something that I will call the Roper effect might take place. The Roper case was a case in which the court overruled, this is the juvenile death penalty case, and the court overruled a precedent that it had decided in 1989 to the effect that it was constitutional to execute people between the ages of 15 and 18. What happened between that case, Stanford versus Kentucky, and Roper is that several states, 22 of the 37 death penalty states, had outlawed such executions. So what the court said in Roper versus Simmons was, well, since we decided Stanford versus Kentucky, a lot of states have said that they don't like that result. So what we see now is a developing national consensus. So we're not going to require the other states to go through the bother of outlawing juvenile death penalties. We'll do it for them. And so we see this consensus developing, and we're just going to declare that it has happened. I don't see why the court couldn't do that in something like Kelo. You know, the states go along and they start passing these laws that say you can't, you know, public use means public use, not public purpose. And the court gets a new case and it says, well, you know, in Kelo we said public purpose means public use means public purpose, but, you know, the states don't think that's right. So at least a few states have done. What we see here is a developing consensus. We're going to overrule Kelo and adopt a new principle. I don't think that's likely to happen under the Roberts Court. And I will leave you with that thought.
Thank you, Lillian. John Jeffries.
Thank you, Dick. I was asked to talk about a couple of cases, Van Orden versus Perry and McCrary County. Both cases involved public governmental displays of the Ten Commandments. Both cases were decided on the same day by the same court with the same nine justices. They came out differently. 5-4 that Texas can display the Ten Commandments and 5-4 that Kentucky cannot. That instability in the Establishment Clause is familiar territory, and it goes very deep. It's not just an instability as to results, which after all shouldn't surprise us. A lot of times there's a necessity to draw a line, and there will be borderline cases where people disagree about whether you're at the line, and that kind of disagreement, I think, comes with the territory. But the disagreement here and the instability goes beyond simply the answer in these cases. It goes to the doctrine, in other words, to what questions the court should be asking about establishment of religion, and it goes to the rationale. There is today a split on the Supreme Court as to what the Establishment Clause is for. The disagreement is fundamental as well as quite showy. I thought I might take a bit of a historical look at this, although since I'm not John Harrison, I'll start in the 20th century. Until 1962, there was a lot of prayer and public religiosity in the American public space, including in schools, and most people didn't think too much about it. 1962, the Supreme Court prohibited government-sponsored school prayer, and that was a big deal. You'll notice that that decision, which essentially said not only that you have a freedom of religion, that is, you get to choose one, but that you have freedom from religion, that you get to have no religion, and that's equally valued. You notice that the court said that in the most, in an implicitly coercive context, the public school classroom, where everybody recites the prayer, and no matter how general it is, and there were usually very non-denominational prayers, there are a couple of kids in the back that don't believe in anything. When everybody else stands up, well, they might feel left out and maybe humiliated. And so the idea of the school prayer case, I think, is pretty accessible. It is that there is something implicitly coercive about government-sponsored prayer in that context. Well, having started that, the court then moved on to a variety of arguably similar cases. No prayer in public schools, no Bible reading in public schools. That was the next year. 1980, Kentucky could not require the Ten Commandments to be posted in every public school classroom and remain there all year on the theory that that was designed to inspire religious belief. No prayer at graduation, 1992, and just to make sure we were consistent, no prayer at football games in 2000. These cases have a lot of sort of fine distinctions, and I want to treat the Supreme Court with great respect, but sometimes it's hard. The two cases that are my favorite are the nativity scene cases. You know these cases? Christmas comes along, and somebody goes down and asks Albemarle County if they can put a nativity scene up on the county courthouse, and they do. And somebody comes by who doesn't believe in Christianity and says, well, that looks like government establishment of religion to me. Well, there are two of these cases. One went to the Supreme Court, 1984. And Chief Justice Berger said, this isn't a direct quote, listen, having a nativity scene at Christmas is not an establishment of religion because Christmas really isn't very religious anymore. It's a shopping season. And so if you want to put the baby Jesus around to kind of stir up activity at the mall, well, that's okay. Even the court got embarrassed about that. So after a few years, they took another case and they had another go at it. And this time they said, okay, we understand that Christmas is religious and that having symbols of Christianity has religious content. So here's the rule. You can have a nativity scene in public property at Christmas if you have something else there with it to kind of dilute the message. So you can have the baby Jesus Joseph, Mary, the angels, the shepherd, the wise men, and Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, that's fine, because Rudolph kind of muddies the waters theologically. But if some teenager comes along and steals Rudolph, everybody has to go. And that's what the Constitution of the United States means, as of the year of our Lord, 1989. Now, when you get to these public arena cases, you understand that they're importantly different from school prayer, because nobody feels coerced, I think, by a passive display in a public place. Maybe you call attention to yourself as an elementary school kid if you don't pray and everyone else does. But if you see the Ten Commandments and you don't pay attention, and I know you don't. That's my only comment about sex. If you see the Ten Commandments and you just don't pay a lot of attention, you can live with that, I think. So these public display cases are kind of tough, and the passive public display, and it's got the court into a real dilemma. It can do one of two things, and neither one is very attractive. The first thing it can do is to say that these religious displays aren't really religious. And there's a history of that. Well, the Ten Commandments isn't really about religion, it's about law giving or something. And the trouble with that, of course, is it is a problem that it's not true, but as lawyers we learn to look beyond that. Another problem is it kind of trivializes religion to take these serious religious statements and treat them as if they are really not connected to religion at all. And yet that's the justification that the courts have given for things like one nation under God, and in God we trust, and the Ten Commandments in public places. We're told they're not really very religious and so forth. They're not objectionable. The other solution, which is also, I think, pretty unattractive, is to insist that the Constitution requires that religion just be purged from the public square, that the government have a kind of hostility to religion in public places, and the majority of the court has not been willing to go there either. So the court is at sea and on knife edge in these cases and doesn't know what to do, neither do I. The two cases came out differently for this reason. The Van Orden case was in Texas, and it's on the... Somebody's been here to the grounds of the Capitol in Austin. Apparently this monument with the Ten Commandments is among 39 monuments and historical markers covering all kinds of stuff. The heroes of the Alamo, the tribute to the Texas school system, Texas pioneer women, and the world-famous Boy Scout Statue of Liberty replica. And because the Ten Commandments are with all this other stuff, it looks not very religious. And so that's okay. Now, the folks in Kentucky, God, I hope no one's dad is involved in this. The folks in Kentucky went out and hired the world's worst lawyer. And this guy said, if you really want to put the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, the way to do it is to surround it with a lot of other religious stuff so that no one will miss what we're about. So they put the Ten Commandments up, and I bought the case because I thought you'd enjoy it. And they put on the wall next to it things like this. They highlighted the passages. They're leading with their chin. They want to make a point about religion. So they highlight the endowed by the Creator passage from the Declaration of Independence and put that up there. They put the preamble to the Constitution of Kentucky. I'm not sure why, but I think it says something about God. They put the national motto, "In God We Trust." They put a page from the Congressional Record proclaiming 1983 the year of the Bible. They put a proclamation from Abraham Lincoln designating April 30th, 1860 day as a national day of prayer and humiliation. When have you heard that from a president? They put another excerpt from President Lincoln's. This is called "The Reply to Loyal Colored People of Baltimore Upon Presentation of the Bible and the Mayflower Compact." Now, when the court got all that stuff around the Ten Commandments, it was like a big neon sign saying, "Religion, religion, religion is what we're about." And the court felt like they had to strike it down. The county, by the way, changed lawyers. After a preliminary injunction, the county changed lawyers. They took down all that stuff. you know, the Magna Carta, things like that. But the court just said, we know what the history is, and this has gone too far. The most remarkable thing about these cases is the dispute that goes all the way down to the core of the Establishment Clause and its purpose. For my life as a lawyer, the understanding of the Establishment Clause has vacillated or been in some tension between notions of separation, by that I mean just the government needs to stay away from religion, period, and neutrality, by which I mean that the government can't endorse a particular religion or favor a particular religion, or perhaps favor religion over non-religion. And there's been, if you look back in the, my colleagues know more about this than I do, but if you look back in the law reviews and the cases, there are lots and lots of sophisticated arguments back and forth about whether separation is the right concept or neutrality is the right concept. And I think it's fair to say, Dick, do you agree with this, that in recent years the movement has been toward neutrality as the governing idea? In these Ten Commandment cases, four justices said that the government did not have to be neutral with respect to religion, that the Establishment Clause did not require neutrality with respect to religion, that given the historical traditions of our country and the origins of the Establishment Clause, it was entirely appropriate for the government to support and endorse religion, so long as it did not support or endorse a particular religion. So that general prayers and broadly applicable documents like the Ten Commandments would be allowed. I think that's new. And I think what it reveals is a willingness on the part of four justices, I'm referring to Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, to look at the whole 30 or 40 years of Establishment Clause jurisprudence and say, it's all been wrong and we should start over and recognize that religion has a valid place in the public space. Now, that's a controversial position, and so I guess is the opposition to it. I'll make only one comment. The interesting thing to me is that both sides of that argument are, in some sense, truly radical. If you learn con law when I did in the 1970s, or even I think in the 1960s, and certainly since then, if you studied con law within my long lifetime as a lawyer, the idea that the government doesn't have any obligation to be neutral as respects religion is radical. And it doesn't depart in some minor detail from the court's work. It overthrows a body of judicial work going back 50 years. On the other hand, Justice Scalia says, if you look at the framing of the country and you look at what happened under Washington and Jefferson, even Jefferson, if you look at what happened in the early days of the country, if you look all the way through the Civil War, you see again and again and again and again exactly the kind of government endorsement of religion that the Supreme Court now says is impermissible. So in the longer frame of reference, the conservative dissenters say that the majority is radical, and there's a sense in which that's true, that they have, since the founding of the Republic, invented an idea that the framers would not have recognized. Well, I think it's very unstable, and my guess is that this will be an issue that during, many of you are first-year students, I imagine, during your 3 years in law school, I suspect you'll see, hear more about this one.
Thank you, John.